Hello and welcome to Religious Roundtable, a program sponsored by the Southern Berkshire Clergy Association and broadcast by our hometown station WSBS Radio. I'm Pastor John Nelson, and I am your moderator for our discussion this morning. I serve as pastor and teacher of Church on the Hill United Church of Christ in Lenox, where soon we will be worshiping at 10:30 this morning and would be delighted to have you join us. And today on Religious Roundtable, we are pleased to have as our guest the Reverend Rich Hayes. Rich is a hospice chaplain and spiritual counselor. He graduated One Spirit Interfaith Seminary and began his hospice career in 1997, becoming chaplain at Hospice Care in the Berkshires in 2006. Rich is a musician, an author, a member of the American Society of Composers, Authors, and Publishers, ASCAP, the Institute of Noetic Sciences, and Spiritual Directors International. Rich offers spiritual direction as well as spiritual counseling to seekers from all traditions. He also specializes in serving persons with dementia and incorporates music as both therapy and as a means to connect with the cognitively impaired. Good morning, Rich. We're delighted you could join us.
It's great to be here. Thanks so much.
So say a word about how it is that you made what seems as though it might be entirely, not an entirely intuitive shift from music into serving as a hospice chaplain. What was that path?
That started not actually intentionally. It was really because I had a very close friend, a man by the name of Peter. We were same age roughly in our early 40s. He became sick and wound up with cancer, and fought the good fight and the struggle over a couple of years. And hospice got involved as things started really declining for him. And I saw what hospice did in helping him. He was not only a good friend, he was in many ways a spiritual mentor to me. And part of what his spirituality was really informed by was being of service to others. So having seen hospice and what hospice did, which was remarkable, he had three small children. I mean, they helped the family, helped in so many ways, and helped my friend die peacefully. I decided after he died that I would repay what they did. So I went into volunteer training, and I became a volunteer. And I spent the next number of years volunteering and meeting remarkable people, and I think that just led me in a very different direction than I really thought I was headed.
Now, when you began doing your ministry, and especially your work in hospice, did you know that music was going to be a really important tool for you right from the outset? Or was that something that you, from your past, one of your practices and capacities that you learned that you could bring into it after you had begun your ministry?
I had no idea. No idea. It was not even a part of what I did as a volunteer.
Interesting. And so how was it that, do you remember anything about the first times that you ended up bringing music into your work with persons who you were serving?
Yeah. You know, along the way as a volunteer, I went and visited people. And saw sometimes that, you know, music was involved, and I could see that it had positive effects on people. But I didn't make the connection with my own music career. You know, I just didn't even think about that. I kind of compartmentalized it. I put it off to the side, and especially when I went back to school and I went to seminary. And at that point, when I had made the decision that I wanted to serve people, and part of what drew me towards that was I saw a lot of people that weren't necessarily affiliated, hadn't been active in any particular church,
right?
And they had needs, and no one was seeing to those needs. So that was really kind of what I was identifying and what I wanted to do. And but still, the idea of using the music hadn't occurred to me. So when I came out, I was hired as a chaplain. I thought to myself, right, I'm here to do spiritual care,
right?
And I kind of defined that in a very simple way. And so I started seeing patients, and I was probably a year into it when I wound up with a patient who was a wonderful woman. She was in a skilled nursing facility. And she And I really, we connected, and I would visit her weekly, and we had some wonderful talks. She did a lot of life review, talked a lot about life, some of the difficulties and challenges, and of course, here she was in her late 80s, cognitively intact, but greatly compromised physically. And she heard that I was a musician, or had been a musician. I did that in my earlier life, so she asked me about that. And she was the one. She asked me one day if I knew the song Shenandoah. Yeah. And I said, well, I know the song, but I've never played it. And she said, would you mind learning that song on your guitar, and could you come in and do that for me? So I did. And I went in, and I sang the song to her. And I was nervous, which is really unusual, because I had performed a lot of years, but I always worked in a band. So I wasn't a soloist. I didn't think of myself in that way, and I wasn't really a singer. But it just had such a positive, her face lit up when I did that song. So she asked me for another song, and I learned another one. And she's in this skilled nursing facility, and other residents start to hear, and they start to ask me. So it was like a light went on. So I owe it all to a woman that I met a number of years ago who made that request. And then I made the connection. This is a great tool.
And it strikes me that it's not only a great tool, certainly a great tool, but also that in a way, that person you were serving was inviting you or calling you to bring all of yourself.
Yes,
that you absolutely had not yet brought an important part of yourself, and somehow she had the insight to identify a part of you that needed to come into the room, and called you to do that.
Absolutely. I agree. And that's a good way to put it. Yeah, she did. I will forever be in her debt, because it was a transformative experience for me. And I wasn't even looking for that. But to be able to use something that I had developed early on in life actually to serve me. Because in all honesty, you know, I was doing music. I loved music, but the bottom line was I wanted to succeed, and it was kind of ego-centered in that way. To have that transformed into something very different, where it's not about me at all. And I'm actually, I mean, I do a lot of music I never would have chosen to do.
Isn't that interesting? Well, that's so interesting. I was just reading with friends recently the part of the story of Joseph from the book of Genesis, which is part of the Judeo-Christian tradition, of course. And there is a line in there that occurs a number of times in Scripture in different stories, where one person says to another, in this case Joseph to his brothers, you meant it for ill, but God used it for good.
Absolutely.
So even when, as I'm not saying that you had meant your music for ill by any means, but even when we make a choice that is very much about satisfying our ego, it turns out that that might be a seed that God is going to turn around and use in a way that is much deeper than our ego can ever go, and much more about forming an intimate connection with another person, with our Creator.
I absolutely agree. I see that in the work that I do oftentimes, and I'm reminded of that in these years I've been doing that work, because you know, I'm meeting people in a, and certainly often a very challenging time, you know, and sometimes meeting people, young people that have been you know, given a disease, or what am I saying, given a disease, have developed some illness that's challenging them in ways they never would have been challenged before. But I've seen out of those awful things, what appear to be awful to us, also great healing, great transformation. And when I talk about the transformation, sometimes, yes, a person is going to die, but before that happens, that awful situation is being used for some good. There is reconciliation that may happen in the family. There is a growth that happens sometimes within that very person. I often actually have seen signs of what I would say are great spiritual growth in people that are kind of having all the things that they've believed themselves to be in life kind of stripped away because they can't do those things, which is frightening for any of us. You know, we're so identified with our roles and who we've been. And you're brought to kind of the edge of that. What's next? Who am I? And, and what's here? So it's kind of terrible, awful grace.
Terrible, awful grace. Terrible, awful grace, meaning the life we have when we no longer have the protection of the roles we've created for ourselves or have embraced for ourselves. I was thinking as you were speaking just now, not exactly a parallel situation, but it reminded me there years ago there was an interview. I can't remember the interviewer, but he was interviewing James Baldwin, the author and prophet, American prophet, and I remember he said to Baldwin, "You were born black, poor, homosexual. Don't you feel as though you started life with a triple jeopardy?" Awful question. And Baldwin sat back and thought and said, "On the contrary, I think I hit the jackpot."
Yeah. Yeah.
So I mean, part of the genius of Baldwin was his ability to embrace the dignity and worth of himself, even in a culture that was actively, fervently denigrating exactly who he was.
Right. Yeah. Right. Right.
Not that we're free of that by any means. These are challenging times in those ways as well.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Sure. But oftentimes, I guess I'm reminded of, my only reference point, I can read a lot of different people. My reference point has been what my journey has told me,
mm-hmm.
you know, because that's been my experience so far. But as I look back and I realize that oftentimes it's been in those places where I really did stumble. I really did. I failed in my definition or the world's definition, too, of a failure.
Yes.
But in that failure were the seeds of something that was just so much greater, and I wouldn't have discovered that without that. Doesn't diminish the pain when you're in the middle of it, but I got to tell you, as I get older, it helps me to understand in a different way what I couldn't understand when I was in my 30s, let's say, you know. And though I actually have conversations with my youngest son, who is in his early 30s, who is going through one of those periods, and he gets a lot more than I ever got back then. he seems to understand it in a different way than I ever could. It is
humbling when our young adult children are leapfrogging over where we were at that point.
it's comforting.
Humbling and comforting.
Humbling and comforting.
I experienced that too with my daughters.
Yeah, yeah.
I read a sermon that you shared with me that you had preached at the Unitarian Society. I can't remember if this was in Pittsfield or in Housatonic. And you wrote, "We love to hate in the world what we hate to love in ourselves."
Yeah.
That's a rich and compact observation. Can you say something a little bit more about that?
Oh boy. I wish I could attribute that to where I heard it, mm-hmm. because it kind of, I don't remember who said that, but it grabbed me because it confounded me at first. I mean,
yes.
What does that mean? What does that mean? But what I've really come to see is that oftentimes, certainly in my own experience, my judgmentalism, my behavior mm-hmm. sometimes, were the things that I really didn't wish to admit that actually I contained within me. So I would project those out and see them elsewhere and then rage against them.
Mm. Mm. And one of the difficulties, I wonder, is there any intersection between the kind of difficulties that we're seeing in our country, in our culture right now, with this fresh outbreak of toxic racism and xenophobia and white supremacy, these forces that are sadly part of the structure of who we are as a people, that we have never reckoned with adequately, so they're coming up to bite us yet again, just as they have been biting the persons of color, immigrants and refugees, without ceasing for all generations. Do you see any intersection between this kind of challenge that we're facing right now and the kind of challenges you see in your ministry as people reckon with who they are and who they long to be?
I see a really similar process occurring.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, to me, what's happened again this time is we've had a mirror held up.
Mm-hmm.
and there is a reflection that we need to look at, which I think that, you know, growing up in the period I grew up in, and you grew up in the same period, mm-hmm. I think that we really believed that we had put a lot of things to right and to rest, but right. we hadn't.
Right.
They became submerged and hidden mm-hmm. from us. And I mean, you know, in my own life, I have no power to change what I cannot see.
Mm. Oh, say that again.
I said, in my own life, I have no power to change what I cannot see.
Such a wise observation. Yeah.
So this uncomfortable and very uncomfortable time, I think, is again an opportunity for us to look deeply at ourselves, to look at not only the myths and the stories we've told ourselves about our past mm-hmm. and who we are collectively as a mm-hmm. people, to look at that and to bring it forth. And Jung said, there is no coming to consciousness without pain. I really feel that we are being called to wake up.
Yes.
And waking up is not. Waking up is hard to do. There's a song parody in this. I hear
there is,
it.
Yeah, I hear that somewhere. There's a melody
Neil Sedaka,
coming.
Forgive me.
Let me just interrupt to say that you are listening to the Religious Roundtable. I am Pastor John Nelson from Church on the Hill, United Church of Christ, hosting today's roundtable for the Southern Berkshire Clergy Association. And our guest today is the Reverend Rich Hayes, who is a hospice chaplain and a musician and a deep soul. You and I, Rich, have spoken a number of times about our appreciation for the work of Father Richard Rohr, the tremendously wise and gifted Franciscan teacher, priest, writer. And you remind me of him yet again when you're commenting just now about the necessity of facing pain if it ever is going to be transformed. And one of Rohr himself has said that probably the thing of his most often quoted is that pithy statement, if we do not transform our pain, we will certainly transmit our pain.
Yeah.
And it strikes me that that's part of what we're talking about also.
Exactly. Yeah. I think that the pain that's not transmuted is transmitted. I remember hearing him use. Mm-hmm. I thought that's a clever play on words too. But what is transmutation? It's that transformation. It's changing it into something else.
Yes. Right.
You know.
Right. I've heard a friend who is a devoted participant in Alcoholics Anonymous say that in the rooms and meetings, the equivalent of that observation of Richard Rohr is hurt people, hurt people.
Yeah.
Which has the similar kind of pithiness. The sort of a saying, the sort of a wisdom that you can carry around because it's so short and let it unpack in your mind over the days and
it can
weeks.
Stay there. Yeah,
yes.
It's not a lengthy quote you're trying to memorize. Yeah.
Which is useful when you get to a certain age.
Oh, very useful. And I think I find, I sometimes when I hear, I have heard that saying many times, and I just think it's brilliant because it says so much in such a brief time. But it's one of those things that can you can interrupt a flow of thought that's going in the direction maybe you don't want to go. Because mm-hmm. I don't know about you, but my mind grabs hold a lot of times and goes down a lot of different roads very quickly.
Yes.
And they can be fear-based, they can be anger-based, they can be any of those things. And sometimes, sometimes I'm not even seeing that. And if I can use some of these tricks, like grabbing a saying like that, it will stop me in my track and it will interrupt that flow.
Right.
You know, and it will just give me a chance to take a breath and remind myself, you know. I think paying attention, and this is kind of a slippery slope, paying attention to what you're thinking is important, but at the same time, you don't want to become obsessed with your thoughts, you know. So there's a balance to that.
There is indeed.
You know.
My wise wife will, with some regularity, ask me if I've climbed into another rabbit hole, which I do with terrible regularity.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I've met you down there sometimes.
Oh, that was you.
That was me.
Well, nice
Rooting
to know as a friend.
Dark, you know? Oh, always. Yeah.
In the same sermon that I read of yours, you made the statement that love is scary to most of us because it calls us to be more than we believe or fear we're capable of being.
Yeah.
Love calls us to be more than we believe we're capable of being or more than we fear we are capable of being.
Mm-hmm.
That is another awfully pithy thing that I'm carrying around to keep unpacking.
Hmm. Yeah. You know, because of the work I do as a hospice chaplain, I do a lot of funerals. And, of course, in a funeral, a lot of times there's a lot of sadness, depending upon... I mean, there's always sadness because there's a sense of loss. But it occurred to me one day, and I've used this in services, that your tears and your broken heart are part of the price we pay for loving.
Right.
But if you look back at your life with this person, aren't you that much better for having had that love? Would you have taken that out of your life? What would your life be like?
Mm-hmm.
We do give ourselves to an eventual breaking when we love something and someone. But it's so well worth it because we're expanded in that place.
I think in a small way that happens in a great work of art, reading a great book, listening to a great symphony or some other tremendous piece of music. It can be emotionally and even physically painful to reach the end.
Yes. Yes.
To the extent that I have given myself over to wherever it was that this great work of art was taking me.
Mm-hmm.
There's a shock and a sadness about having to go back to the quote-unquote real world.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, we mourn.
Yeah. 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 And that is, of course... A tiny example of what happens in a meaningful relationship, which is calls vastly more of me to be present and hurts vastly more when it ends by separation or loss.
Yeah. I think that when I think about what love does call us to do, it's to go beyond the borders that we've set for ourselves. It always is.
Hmm.
And that's frightening because we are called to places that we wouldn't go.
I love that you say it in that way. Love calls us to go beyond the borders we have set for ourselves, especially right now. One of the things that, as you know, that I'm involved with is ministry looking to be effective advocates for immigrants and refugees.
Mm-hmm.
And we're in a time that is really scary for immigrants and refugees. And the notion that love calls us to go beyond borders resonates all the more deeply because borders are such, they're occasionally necessary, but they are often troublesome and frequently hurtful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think... You know, I'm going to bring Jesus into the mix here now.
Always good with me.
You know, yeah. I think what is so radical about what he says is he calls us to that all the time, to go beyond the border, to go to that place of love, to love that which you don't think is lovable. So here we are in a time where we're seeing people that it's very easy for whatever your view is, whatever side you have decided to take, and you're responding in a certain way. And, you know, the only thing that's ever going to really fix this actually is love, because obviously hate and anger just perpetuates more of the same.
Right. It's interesting you mentioned that Jesus teaches to go beyond borders, to love that which we had not thought of as lovable. Those of us who are in church today, Sunday the 20th, may very well be hearing a difficult story from the Gospel of Matthew about when Jesus went beyond the borders of Israel. He traveled north to Tyre and Sidon. And so there's a border crossing right there. And then he had a confrontation with a Canaanite woman whom he put off in what I think any fair reading will reveal to be a terribly rude and mean way. And so even Jesus had the experience of reaching a border that he had difficulty crossing.
Yeah.
You know, his first reaction to that woman could not have been described as loving. And yet, because she came back at him with such integrity and with such determination, even he was able to cross the border that he needed to cross and establish a relationship, a healing relationship with her, and healed her daughter.
You know, one of the things that I think we lose something when we make Jesus always God.
Mm-hmm.
He was a human being. He struggled like we struggled. Mm-hmm. How else could he know what he knew if he hadn't experienced all the other stuff too?
Right. Right.
And so here this woman was actually, she was a teacher to him.
Exactly.
And he recognized that.
Exactly.
And that to me is inspirational. I was having a conversation with my brother this weekend about, again, this idea that Jesus knows, because he has suffered all those things. He knows what it's to be a human being.
Right.
There's a vast area. We don't know what he was doing, where he was.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But he was living life. We know that.
Yes.
And he was probably struggling with his own insecurities about stepping up to maybe what he was feeling called to do. I mean, we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But I do trust that he does understand, you know, how difficult those borders are. And yet, he came to tell us the importance of going to them and going beyond them and the truth.
And when we are not capable of going beyond the borders that we really need to go beyond, it's likely that we're going to get a lesson from somebody like the Canaanite woman on the other side of the border.
Yeah. And it's, you know, I'm just sitting here, I'm thinking to myself, the work that I do, which is, you know, is kind of specialized in the sense I'm really working with people, you know, as they move towards the end of life.
Yes.
I'm not serving a congregation of different needs. I'm serving a kind of specific, even though each experience is very unique to each person, depending upon their life. But what I'm doing is I'm walking with them to another border, another threshold, and saying, fear not.
That is a powerful thing. And what do you say when they ask you about what's on the other side of that threshold?
I said, well, that, you know, having not crossed it myself, having only sat in the presence of what I have experienced,
right?
My experience is there is love that our mind cannot comprehend.
Mm. Beautiful, yes.
But what that experience will be like, all I can do sometimes when appropriate is I will share with some people what a few people have shared with me of experientially as they've moved and been able to start to perceive that. So, you know, but love beyond our comprehension. I think, you know, it will blow your mind.
Mm-hmm. There's another song in there somewhere.
Someone probably already did that one.
Well, it's nearing time to bring our discussion to a close, although I would be happy to continue it. Maybe we should make this part one and see if we can get a 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 or 20-part series going.
I would love it, John. I would be more than happy to come back. We scratched the surface.
Well, we'll look forward to doing that. And in the meantime, I want to thank you, Reverend Rich Hayes, for taking the time to be with us this morning on Religious Roundtable. And I also want to thank WSBS, our hometown station, for their ongoing support for the Religious Roundtable. We hope that you will join us next Sunday morning for another of these roundtable discussions, and now wish you God's richest blessings on your day.
Table is pre-recorded in the WSBS studios on Stockbridge Road in Great Barrington. Any comments, viewpoints, or materials presented by the hosts and guests of the show do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of WSBS Radio and Gamma Broadcasting.